I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The White House says the diplomatic window has been closed. A second UN resolution on disarming Saddam Hussein has been taken off the table by Britain, Spain, and the U.S., and President Bush will address the nation tonight. It now appears that war with Iraq is inevitable.
And today we're asking, how do you feel?
I'm scared. I think that I'm unprepared for it, and I think I'm in denial of it. When Bush steps a foot in there and says we're going to war, we're all going to war. It's not just him.
Obviously, we don't want human bloodshed. And on the other hand, my head goes back to World War II. Perhaps if we stopped Hitler in his tracks, then we wouldn't have had this decimation of 20 million people.
The U.S. and President Bush in particular ought not to be going to war alone and are going to war for exactly the wrong reasons. I think that by doing so, are probably increasing the risk of terror attacks. So personally, I feel very nervous about this because, you know, for the first time in my life, I have the sense that my life is actually in danger as a result of terror attacks, which probably wouldn't be the case if we weren't going after Saddam Hussein.
Thoughts on war from some people we spoke with today.
Well, Secretary of State Colin Powell this morning said the world diplomacy regarding Iraq is no longer an option.
I think the time for diplomacy has passed. A lot of people have been talking to each other this morning and overnight, and it became clear that it would be best at this time to withdraw the resolution, and I can think of nothing that Saddam Hussein could do diplomatically. I think that time is now over. He had his chance. He's had many chances over the last 12 years, and he has blown every one of those chances.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking at the State Department today, explaining why the U.S., Spain, and Britain have withdrawn their second resolution on military action against Iraq. President Bush will be making his case to the nation tonight. Well, joining us from the United Nations is AP radio reporter Warren Levinson. Warren, hello.
Hello, Robin.
Well, 4 months ago, the U.S. had unanimous support for their first resolution on action against Iraq. Now the support is not there. In fact, a senior member of Tony Blair's cabinet resigned this morning over the issue of Iraq. What are the implications first there?
Well, the implications are essentially that the Security Council is quite fractured, and it will be difficult to regain the unity that the Council had back in November going forward on perhaps Iraq and perhaps a whole host of other issues. It's really hard to say.
Well, we also heard this morning that the U.S. advised the weapons inspectors to pull the inspectors from Iraq. Do we know if there's any movement there?
We don't. At this moment as we speak, the members of the Security Council are consulting behind closed doors, and since they no longer have a resolution to debate, since that's been withdrawn, we have to assume that that's the major event on the agenda. In fact, our understanding is the Guinean ambassador, who is the president of the Security Council for the month, called this meeting specifically to discuss, all right, the U.S. has advised that weapons inspectors leave the country. What are we going to do about it? Because the weapons inspectors, after all, take their orders from the council.
Right. And according to reports, President Bush is going to be issuing yet another ultimatum, possibly the final one, to Saddam Hussein, saying that he must leave Iraq in order for no military action to take place. If he doesn't leave, we know others are. NBC is the first network to pull its reporters out, and people are apparently packing and leaving Baghdad. Give us a further sense of what's happening at the United Nations that, you know, what is obviously a failure of negotiations.
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, the arguments are familiar. We have heard them over and over for quite a few weeks now. The United States and Great Britain saying, look, you all voted for serious consequences in November. What did you think that meant? It's time for us to stand up and say that he's not, that Saddam Hussein has not done what he had to do in order to avoid serious consequences. On the other side, the majority of the council, we have to say, led by the French, saying, we don't think war is the answer here. The arguments are familiar, but what was different was the tone. As the British ambassador, Jeremy Greenstock, went into the closed meeting today, he specifically said one country rejected this even before the Iraqis rejected this. You rarely hear that kind of animus directed from one country to another.
Warren, before we let you go, just a sense of what's happening at the UN today. I'm picturing people running from door to door, but what's happening?
Not exactly. Right now, what's happening at the UN is the council's meeting behind closed doors, talking about what they're going to do about the weapons inspectors. Are they going to pull them out right away, or are they going to do something else? There's also a meeting scheduled of the Security Council this afternoon at which they'll talk about the work program submitted by Hans Blix on future weapons inspections. That's something that could be made moot by events on the ground, though.
Mm. Warren, thank you.
You bet.
Associated Press reporter Warren Levinson, he spoke to us from the United Nations.
For so many months, we've talked about the possibility of war. Now we speak about its inevitability. in as soon as the next 24 hours even, or at least the next few days. For perspective, we turn now to three journalists. Andrea Stone is a correspondent for USA Today. She joins us from U.S. Central Command in Doha, Qatar. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there.
Bill Douglas is Washington correspondent for Newsday. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
And a special guest to the roundtable today, Tim Malloy, reporter for Scripps Howard television stations, who's embedded with U.S. troops in Kuwait and has just been up at the Iraqi border. Tim, what's the sense there of when the fighting may start?
Well, I'm back at Camp Arifjan, Bill, now, and the sense here is that it's imminent. Everybody's going to be huddled around the television early today when the president speaks. There is a sense, there's more suddenly more MPs in the camp. There's more guys wearing that so-called battle rattle, meaning full battle gear, and there's a sense of inevitability here. Although no one's telling you so, you do get that sense.
How does that sense of inevitability translate emotionally, if you will? Are the soldiers showing something on their faces or in how they're behaving with war possibly so close?
Suddenly there's more vehicles through the camp. There's helicopters on the perimeter. I don't believe it's my imagination. There is I'm mainly with the Army here, and an awful lot of Army as well as British military. And I can't really put it into words, but you get a feeling that these guys know that even if they're not up at the front, and some of them will not be, they know this thing is about to go. Just watching the president last night with many of them in a room that had a cable TV, you could just watch them lean in. You knew that they now knew that this was, not if, but when.
Yeah. Andrea, in Qatar, you're at Corps Central Command. What's the mood there?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of surreal. You go over to the base, and people over there say, we're not open for business. We're still in the diplomatic phase. That's sort of been the line here for weeks. And, obviously people are in the command center where General Franks will basically run this war. And there's a million-dollar-plus media center that's almost geared up. We were hoping they were going to get the telephone lines working today. I'm not quite sure they got that in. But you go over there and they say, we're just doing our thing and we're not really open for business. But obviously they're getting ready for something.
Hmm. Bill Douglas, the mood in Washington.
Just like the mood everywhere else, the sense that this is going to happen soon, one way or the other. Lawmakers watched the president yesterday, and a couple who I talked to this morning just feel it's just a question of when or how soon.
Bill, is there a sense in Washington, at least among some, that this is a turning point in our whole geopolitical relationship, or is there a sense more practical that this will be over quick and we'll get back to normal?
No, not back to normal. There is a sense that this is something that's going to change the face of a lot of things, of how we deal with other countries, particularly how we deal in the Middle East. There are some fears, mostly among Democrats, that just the world as we've known it is going to change dramatically.
The French Minister of Defense was passing through here in Qatar yesterday, and she said at a press conference, that really still taking that hard line that this was really going to be an illegal war, that they could not support it, but also saying that the French were very interested in, after the war, Iraq, they were interested in reconstruction. I'm not sure how much President Bush is going to be interested in letting the French come in and help after not getting a whole lot of support on this end. But, I do get a sense there is a real shifting, really, since for the first time since the Cold War began, this really will be a new world order, even more so than the current president's father said around the time of the first Gulf War.
Yes, Tim Malloy over there in Kuwait. Is there any sense of relief that you can detect among soldiers that this long wait may now finally be over?
Yeah, actually, I got out to Udari. Andrea had been up there, too. It's right up near the border, and several of the camps up there, New York and Virginia. And not only are they in sweltering heat up there and uncomfortable, but they're very impatient, and even down here. And just quickly to add, the French ambassador came on television this morning, and there was a chorus of boos in the tent, so they're paying attention to that pretty closely here. But my sense of being around a lot of soldiers recently, even two generals who I've interviewed, is that I guess these things reach a certain crescendo, and everybody is just ready to roll. You know, either roll or go home.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't want to sit around in the desert. You know, Tim, more than I do about these terrible sandstorms they've been having up there, and that's before the
amazing
first shot has been fired.
Yeah, I mean, you can't breathe. It's not only is it hot, it's suffocatingly claustrophobic, too. I mean, these are 20-year-old kids sitting up there, and, you know, they're tough as nails, but this is scary. I could admit. I'm a 50-year-old man. I've been around a bit. I'm up there in the desert, you know, you're up there all alone in these outposts, you know, 5 miles from Iraq, and you say, you know what? This is a little frightening.
Yeah, indeed. There's a final little feather in the wind, which all three of you know about, the call for Saddam Hussein to go into exile that came from President Bush yesterday. Is anybody taking that seriously at all over there?
I don't think there's any indication he's going anywhere soon, at least not on his own. What do you think, Bill?
It's a big wish in Washington, and there have been efforts, and there probably still are efforts underway from other countries to persuade Hussein to go into exile. We saw some interesting press leakage of Hussein and family and Iraqi officials who the U.S. said would face war crimes if a war did happen. That was designed to encourage these folks to think twice about going to war and think two or three times about accepting an exile offer. It's pretty remote at this point, but it's something that people would really, really like.
Today he would fight the war with sticks and stones. If it's a bluff, that's a pretty convincing one.
Yeah. You know? We want to thank all three of you for joining us on the eve of what seems now to be inevitable war with Iraq. Andrea Stone is a correspondent for USA Today. She joined us from U.S. Central Command in Doha, Qatar. Thanks, Andrea.
My pleasure.
Bill Douglas, Washington correspondent for Newsday. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
And Tim Malloy, reporter for Scripps Howard television stations, who's embedded with U.S. troops in northern Kuwait. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Talk to you soon, Bill.
Thanks, all three.
And this note, in the next day or two, Iraqi officials were scheduled to deliver a report to the United Nations on Iraq's missing stockpile of anthrax, almost 3,000 gallons. Last Friday and Saturday, the Iraqis delivered an 82-page report on another deadly agent, the nerve gas VX. UN's weapons inspector Hans Blix had repeatedly asked for an accounting of both weapons, specifically citing discrepancies in Saddam Hussein's claim that he destroyed the nerve gas immediately after the Gulf War. In the past, Iraq claimed to have lost documents of the destruction. With war imminent, there's no word on whether Hans Blix will now accept the anthrax report. And U.S. officials had already dismissed the reports last week, saying they were too late.
Just ahead, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy shares his thoughts on war with Iraq.
And later, health officials concerned about a mysterious and deadly respiratory ailment that so far has no cure.
And an eyewitness on the young American protester killed by an Israeli army bulldozer.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. President Bush is expected to tell the nation that Saddam Hussein must leave or be forcibly removed when he speaks to the nation tonight at 8. That speech will be carried live on WBUR. For more on the situation, log on to our website, WBUR.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the 10 o'clock news on WB56, relevant and to the point, with Karen Marinella and Frank Malicote and Emmy Award-winning meteorologist Mike Wonkum. The 10 o'clock news on WB56, Boston's 10 p.m. news leader. And TechFusion.com, a local IT company providing on-site network and hardware support for small and large companies for the last 16 years. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. 60s inland, 40s on the coast when the sea breeze sets in. Right now it's 58 in Boston at 1221.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The British Parliament will meet in emergency session today for debate over a war that may be just days away. The Turkish Parliament recently debated allowing U.S. troops to pass through their country on the way to the highlands of northern Iraq. Demonstrators for and against the war gathered across the United States this weekend. But the one Democratic forum that seems to have been almost silent on the topic of possible war with Iraq is the United States Congress. There have been pockets of protest of the Bush administration's policy. And joining us right now is Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts. Good afternoon, Senator.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Well, you spoke out against the use of force at this time against Iraq, most recently in a speech to the United Methodist Church. And here we are. Your thoughts today as the White House is saying the diplomatic window is closed.
Well, I'm very disappointed that we didn't give inspectors more time to work. They were making progress. They were facing obstacles, but we were working with the world community and making important progress. I think that should have been given a further chance. We could have kept military on alert in the region. Certainly that would have been less expensive in terms of lives and in treasure than going to war.
Well, Senator Kennedy, what do you say to the reluctant hawks, they're being called, the liberals who side with the president, writer Paul Berman and others, who say, first of all, it's a scandal that thousands of people, liberals especially, aren't marching in support of oppressed Iraqis, that liberals weren't pushing sooner to take on the Taliban, that being anti-war 30 years ago was one thing, but in the 90s, being a liberal means being in favor of military intervention, especially after Bosnia and Kosovo.
Well, I'm not going to get into trying to anticipate what a lot of other people might have said at other times. What I am concerned about is what we are presented with today. And today we have been seen that we're making progress with the international community on inspections on disarming Saddam Hussein. And we ought to continue that process. The administration has made a decision based upon their own judgment that Saddam Hussein presents an imminent threat to the security of the American people. I don't think that case has been made, and clearly it hasn't. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been made in terms of the world community, and I don't think it's been made to the American people. The nature of the threat that we're facing is still North Korea. They have the nuclear weapons. They have a missile that can reach the United States. They are the nuclear threat, and we are also have to give continued focus and attention to the issues of terrorism. We have to look at what we are going to about to do in Iraq and how it is going to impact terrorism around the world. We are about to inflame the Middle East by unilateral action. We're breaking the coalition that came together after 9/11. And I think that this is not the way that we should be going.
Mm. I'm thinking also of Kenneth Pollack, who, as you know, was a former Clinton administration official. His book was called The Threatening Storm. And he's one of those liberals who says the choice we have before us is we either go to war now or we will never go to war with Saddam until he chooses to use a nuclear weapon. Do you see the reasoning of people who think that a deterrent is necessary?
Well, North Korea has the ability to deliver nuclear weapons today. The regime in North Korea has been about as vicious and mean and in terms of torturing prisoners and committing these heinous crimes as Saddam Hussein has. Finally, I just say the administration feels that this is a threat for the countries in the area and the region. Well, if it is, then why isn't Turkey aboard? Yeah. They should be as great a threat to Turkey. Why are the countries in the region not as concerned as the United States? That has to tell you something.
Well, Senator Kennedy, why aren't more Democrats aboard with you? I'm thinking of many of the presidential candidates as well, John Kerry, John Edwards, Joe Lieberman.
You have to ask those candidates. They all like to get on your program, and I think they've expressed their views on these matters.
But why did so many Democrats vote for the congressional resolution giving the president the right to use force?
I think most of them felt that if they went to the United Nations, they felt that they would have a United Nations resolution to this problem. What has been happened now is effectively we have a go-it-alone administration at the present time, and we're going to hear from the president tonight, and I think we'll be at war before the end of the week.
Senator Kennedy, you in the Congress will be actually discussing the cost of the war this week. Will that discussion be impacted by the fact that we might be at war? Is there any possibility for debate about the cost of the war once we're in war?
The most we will be covering what they call the budget, which is the amount of total resources that we'll be expending, including spending and tax reductions over the period of these next 5 years. I'm in strong support of an amendment that will be offered on behalf of all the Democrats that says we should not provide any further tax breaks, reductions, until we find out the cost of the war, the cost of occupation, and the cost of withdrawing the American troops from that area. Before we go ahead and have further tax reductions, we ought to get those that information and be able to debate it and take action on it. Rather than go ahead and have another $1 trillion worth of tax cuts. And I hope our Republican friends will support that.
Senator Kennedy, why wasn't there more debate between you and your colleagues, with the exception of yourself and Senator Byrd? It just didn't feel like we were hearing much.
Well, I think that that's true. There, it would have. I think anyone who watches certainly the debate at in Parliament sees the difference. Of course, there was more exchanges in the committees. I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and we had a series of meetings and on a variety of different issues, and there was exchanges, but those were kept, the public were kept out of those because they were labeled to be secret. I don't think that they should have been classified secret myself, but there were the exchanges that were going on in the committee process. But I firmly believe that we should have had the a strong debate. The president has the power as a commander-in-chief. We have it in the ability to declare war. And if the president is taking this kind of action now, after having gone to the United Nations and effectively abandoning them, I think he should have come back to the Senate of the United States and presented the reasons, permitted us to vote on it, and give the American people some accountability. I think that that is what should have happened, instead of the president using a resolution that passed 5 months ago as authority to go to war.
Senator Kennedy, thank you so much.
Very much.
Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy speaking to us from Boston.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, reaction to President Bush's address to the nation tonight on Iraq.
And the cult-like following of hockey fans who care more about the fights than the game. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, Queen Noor of Jordan, the American-born fourth wife of the late King Hussein, will talk about the relationship between the Arab world and the West and her own relationship to Islam and the Middle East. Queen Noor's memoir is called Leap of Faith, and that's coming up at 1 o'clock. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Uterceuticals, the maker of Better Woman, a Chinese herbal formula helping to improve urinary continence, frequency, and control naturally. Available at Bread and Circus or BetterWomanNow.com. And Chez Henri, featuring Chef Paul O'Connell's Latin-inspired cuisine in a bistro setting at 1 Shepherd Street, outside Harvard Square, and at BostonChefs.com. This spring, join NPR's Scott Simon and Robert Siegel on our next Citizens of the World tour, exploring the natural wonders of Africa. To learn more about the trip, call 800-909-9287. At 12:30, the temperature reading is 58 degrees.
I'm Bill Delaney. As tensions with Iraq intensify, the future of the Middle East hangs in the balance. Through it all, the BBC continues to bring an international perspective to global events. Join me and correspondents from the BBC on Monday, April 14th, as we examine the past and look at the possible future of Iraq and the Middle East. Presented in cooperation with the Providence Journal. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-753-9764.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, concern over an unknown and deadly respiratory ailment.
There appears to be no treatment in regards to antivirals or antibiotics that are working. So most of the people that have come down with this are being provided supportive care.
Also, a U.S. peace protester in the Gaza Strip is killed by an Israeli army bulldozer.
And breaking from the darker news, the new appeal of country music.
And then, of course, you have these crossover acts like Garth Brooks and Shania Twain, who are much more pop in the first place than they ever were country and western, even if they launched from Nashville.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the standoff over Iraq cannot continue indefinitely. Powell's statement followed word that the U.S., Britain, and Spain have abandoned efforts to win approval for their latest U.N. resolution, one that called on Saddam Hussein to disarm.
Despite best efforts to see whether or not language could be adjusted to make it more acceptable to council members, it is clear that there are some permanent members of the council that would veto any such resolution or any resolution resembling the one that the British tabled Friday before last at the United Nations.
Powell says President Bush's speech tonight will warn Iraq that unless Saddam Hussein leaves, Iraq will face serious consequences. United Nations weapons inspectors say they are prepared to evacuate Iraq as soon as tomorrow morning. Chief Inspector Hans Blix and top nuclear inspector Mohammed El-Baradei say the United States has advised them to begin pulling out of Iraq, but Blix says he has not yet ordered the pullout. Even though it looks as though diplomatic efforts to disarm Iraq are ending, Russian President Vladimir Putin is still calling for a peaceful settlement to the crisis. Putin says he supports a French call for a ministerial meeting at the UN today to discuss the latest weapons report from Inspector Hans Blix. Putin says a war against Iraq could threaten world security. A senior British cabinet member resigned today, protesting his government's decision to back military action against Iraq. Former Foreign Secretary and leader in the House of Commons, Robin Cook, resigned his post in a private meeting with Prime Minister Tony Blair. Cook is now expected to lead opposition over the next 2 days of debate in Parliament over Blair's handling of the crisis. Police have arrested the widow of a Serbian crime boss connected with the assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic last week. Police say the woman, a popular folk singer in the country, was arrested for her close ties to an underworld group targeted in Djindjic's assassination last week. Trouble today for the apparel and home furnishing retailer Spiegel. The company, which also faces a federal complaint it violated security laws, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection today following a long-term decline in its credit card business. Spiegel officials say they hope to keep all stores and catalog operations in business throughout the bankruptcy process. Good news on Wall Street. The numbers are up. 193 of the Dow at 8,056. The NASDAQ up is up 35 at this hour. This is Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Jordan's Furniture, furnishing houses and creating homes for families in partnership with Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange. Information at 617-54-ADOPT. And Executive Auto Glass, installing original factory glass and sealants with certified technicians to help ensure the safety of their customers. 1-800-NEW-GLASS. Revised forecast for this afternoon calls for a two-track temperature, 55 to 70 inland, dropping into the 40s this afternoon when the sea breeze picks up. Tonight will be cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight and lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow mostly cloudy in the morning and then becoming mostly sunny. Cooler, with highs only in the lower 40s everywhere, not just along the coast. Wednesday will be mostly sunny with highs near 40. Thursday, clouds move in, rains likely at night, highs in the upper 40s. Friday, showers, mid-50s, upper 50s. Saturday with showers, back in the 40s on Sunday. It's 12:35.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new respiratory syndrome that has struck more than 150 people around the world is being called a worldwide threat. But so far, health officials say little is known about the pneumonia-like illness, which was first spotted in China. Joining us to discuss this disease and its implications is Tom Skinner of the Centers for Disease Control in Washington. Tom, tell us, first of all, people are very nervous about this. What are the symptoms of this disease?
Well, I want to be very clear, and we don't want to unduly alarm people in the United States. And what we're saying is people that are presenting with fever, difficulty breathing, cough, and they have a specific travel history to the affected regions. If they're returning and they have these symptoms, we want them to go and see their clinician right away. We're actually in the process, beginning yesterday, of handing out health alert notices to individuals returning on aircraft around various ports of entry in the United States.
Have there been any cases in the U.S.? Remind us where the cases have been.
Most of the cases that have been seen are in various parts of Asia, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and other parts of Asia. Since we sent out our notice to clinicians across the United States over the weekend about the situation, we've heard of about a dozen or so cases of individuals in the United States with a travel history that are being carefully examined right now. But as of right now, we don't have any cases in the United States.
What about the sense that the cases are being transported, as you say, on airplanes, and that there is at least one case of a man who had to be taken off an airplane?
Yeah, we're doing everything we can to monitor individuals and monitor aircraft that are coming back to the United States from that part of the world. We have people stationed at various points of entry, and we're handing out these health alert notices.
And again, the symptoms we're hearing, high fever, flu-like symptoms, headaches, sore throats.
Yeah, basically the symptoms we're talking about are temperature of 100.4 or higher, difficulty breathing, cough, respiratory ailments, general muscle aches and malaise. But again, the travel history is really key here right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're wanting to really reach those individuals that have a travel history to that part of the world.
We understand that the victims of this illness don't seem to be responding to antibiotics, which is what leads people like you to think it is a virus as opposed to a bacteria, which is killed by antibiotics.
Well, let me be very clear. We don't know what's causing this. We don't know if it's a virus or a bacteria, and we're doing everything we can to try to get the appropriate specimens here at CDC to try and figure out what's causing this. But you're right. There appears to be no treatment in regards to antivirals or antibiotics that are working. So most of the people that have come down with this are being, you know, provided supportive care, you know, being put on respirators in cases or ventilators when they need help breathing and that sort of thing.
There is speculation about what it is. Is it, as some speculate, a new flu?
We may be looking at an entirely new agent that's never been recognized, or we may be looking at a strain of influenza that's never been recognized, but we're doing everything we possibly can to get to the bottom of this.
And again, what's the speculation as to how it might be passed from person to person?
We believe that you must have close contact with an infected individual and that you come into direct contact with such an individual through exchange of nose and throat secretions, that sort of thing.
We hear that a worldwide health alert was issued on Saturday, and that's very rare. Is that true, and how seriously are health officials taking this?
Well, I can tell you that health officials around the world are taking this very seriously, and the reason they're taking this very seriously is we're looking at an agent that we can't figure out, and it appears to be spreading from person to person. Health officials around the world really are applying a full court press.
Tom, one last thing. Have you been able to rule out any form of bioterrorism?
Well, you know, we've certainly learned from the anthrax attacks a couple of years ago to keep an open mind when we investigate outbreaks. And so we certainly are keeping an open mind in this investigation as well. But everything to date suggests that what we're seeing is just a naturally occurring outbreak.
Tom, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tom Skinner with the Centers for Disease Control in Washington, D.C.
An American peace activist was killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in the Gaza Strip yesterday. Rachel Corey, 23 years old, from Olympia, Washington, was attempting to prevent the bulldozer from destroying Palestinian homes. Israeli officials said the operation was intended to destroy buildings used to shelter Palestinian terrorists, and Israel described the incident as a very regrettable accident. 9 Palestinians, including a 4-year-old girl, were also killed in further violence today. Now, Tom Dale is in the West Bank town of Rafah. He is a member of the International Solidarity Movement, the same group to which Rachel Corey belonged. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, you were there when this happened. Tell me what you saw. What happened?
The group had been observing the actions of 2 bulldozers and 2 tanks along the Rafah border when one bulldozer turned towards a Palestinian home. Rachel placed herself in between the bulldozer and the home, kneeling on the ground. And when she did so, the bulldozer in question was 10 to 15 meters away from her. And it's important to emphasize at this point there is absolutely no way that the drivers of the bulldozer could not have known that she was there. It was daylight. She was standing alone in a barren area, wearing an orange fluorescent jacket with reflective stripes, and the bulldozer was moving slowly towards her, and the crew have an elevated view of the entire area. As the bulldozer got close to her, the activists around began to see that she was in trouble. We shouted through a megaphone and we gestured that Rachel was trapped under the bulldozer. The bulldozer driver continued going. He pushed her not only under the blade, but kept on going until she was under the treads. When he withdrew, He did not lift his blade off the ground so that she was run over a second time. And we should emphasize that not only did the bulldozer drivers have their own vision, but also the vision of the tanks around them, which could see from the sides and with whom they were in radio contact.
Tom, tragic as this incident is, and Israel itself acknowledges it as a tragedy, Israel is fighting a war, Israeli officials will tell you. And when they are going after men in buildings that they say threaten their people, you are putting yourself on the front lines. Isn't it inevitable that sooner or later on a front line, someone is going to be killed?
The first point I'd make was that in the area at the time we were there, there had been absolutely no Palestinian resistance of any kind. Not a single shot was fired. The second point I'd make is that the homes slated for demolition in Rafah, as far as I know, that there's not even the pretense that all of them contain terrorists. They're merely those which lie within 100 meters of the wall to be built along Rafah's border. And unless they're saying that anyone who lives within 100 meters of a line they make up is necessarily a terrorist, I don't see how they can possibly maintain that accusation.
Final question. Do you feel like you're changing anything over there?
I feel absolutely certain that we have done. There have been times when we have turned back bulldozers, when we have had success, as well as in so many smaller and maybe more important ways with doing things like protecting water workers to ensure that people of Rafah are able to drink clean water.
Tom Dale, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Tom Dale is in the West Bank town of Rafah. He is a member of the International Solidarity Movement. A final note, the U.S. government has called for a full investigation into the incident.
There's more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Residents of Ely, Minnesota, woke up a while back to find that theirs was one of 150 towns and cities across America officially against war in Iraq, to which many of them responded, "Oh, really?" In fact, Haines, Pennsylvania, another small town, and Ely, Minnesota, became the only two American towns to rescind their city council anti-war resolutions. And on the line to talk about Ely's change of heart is resident Bob Carey. Hi, Bob.
Well, you're glad to be on board.
What happened when you woke up and found out that the city council voted on a resolution against war in Iraq?
We had meetings around here for a while, and the peace people read it out and made their talks and whatever, and that's fine. We're a very tolerant community. But then all of a sudden, one night, a bunch of them showed up down at the city council, and they ran this thing through, boom, bow, and all of a sudden, the council had voted a rather strange thing against war in Iraq. So that irritated no end of people in the community.
Why?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is, that isn't how you get peace. I was part of the peace activists of 1942 to 45, and we buried 300,000 of us, and 670,000 of us got wounded, including me.
In other words, you fought in World War II to fight for the peace.
Somebody had to go out and die for it, or we didn't have peace and we didn't have freedom, either one. Mm. Those of us who served and earned that freedom for these people, we were very quick to point out to them that the reason they could hold their meetings and the reason that they had the freedom of speech was because a lot of us got popped and a lot of them got buried, and they weren't interested.
What happened at the meeting where the vote was rescinded?
The place was pretty well packed.
Yeah. And what did you say?
What did I say? Well, I said it was very interesting that when President Clinton went into Bosnia and when he sent the bombers in and popped Slobodan Milosevic there in Sarajevo, there wasn't one single meeting and one single peace drive, nothing. In fact, he was hailed as a hero. And then when President Clinton sent the rockets into Iraq in 1998, there was no meetings, there was nothing. All of a sudden, when Bush does something, boy, he's become the world's worst everything. And when I went to these meetings, this is the thing that permeated. Everything that's wrong in the world, the United States did it. And I got sick of listening to these people. And I said, wait a minute, come on here. And really put a clinker in this town. But they were so proud of that fact that they had got that thing through, they got it on the wire immediately. So it went to CNN, went all over the country. And our Chamber of Commerce was going nuts down there. They had, the first three or four days, they had 1,500 cancellations of trips, people coming in here. Because we're a tourist town. Mm. We got smacked. People calling in wants to know what's the matter with Ely. Oh, man. We didn't need that at all.
I hear you were a former senior editor of Ely's Echo newspaper.
I was the oldest person there. I was there before anybody and helped build the paper up, worked pretty hard at it. And when I saw what was unfolding, it didn't have anything to do with peace particularly. It was bash the United States and bash the president. Hmm. So I went up to the publisher and I said, look, what's going on here? And she started in with the same thing, and I said, well, we're in a national emergency, lady. And when we're in a national emergency, I support the troops, and I also support the commander-in-chief. And I said, this is the day that we part company. Goodbye.
Well, what would you have liked to have seen, Bob? Would you have liked to have seen the city council take a poll of the town? How would you?
It's not the city council's business to run national issues. It's the city council's business to run the city, and they got enough trouble in that city.
Well, Bob, thank you.
Pleasure being on.
Bob Carey, resident of Ely, Minnesota, and now a reporter for the nearby Mesabi Daily News.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tonight at 7, On Point with Tom Ashbrook, William Crystal on War with Iraq and the Roadmap for Peace in the Middle East, plus two Texas journalists weigh in on presidential advisor Karl Rove's relationship with President George Bush. That's tonight at 7, On Point with Tom Ashbrook, and then during Tom's program, of course, we'll carry live President Bush addressing the nation. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5, providing business and consumer banking services since 1855, with offices in Boston and throughout the North Shore, 1-888-662-5500. And Boston Design Center, find furniture, fabrics, antiques, kitchens, bath, and home electronics featured in 75 showrooms on South Boston's waterfront, bostondesign.com. Join host Robin Young and explore the treasures of ancient Egypt at the Museum of Science exhibit March 24th. 800-909-9287 for information.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It appears that aging rock and roll fans have chosen a new form of music to take them gently into that good night. The airwaves are littered with country, songs by Faith Hill, Shania Twain, Garth Brooks. Johnny Cash has a hit with that great song, Hurt.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
But another elder statesman, George Strait, is not all that happy with the direction that country is taking.
Oh, the steel guitar's no longer dry, and you can't hear fiddles play. With drums and rock and roll guitar mixed right up in your face. Why the hag, he ain't got a chance on today's radio. Since they committed murder and had all music wrong.
Well, George, what used to be called country crossover is now the norm, and our rock and pop critic Tim Riley is in the studio to talk about it. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Robin.
Well, George Strait's sentiments echo a lot of diehard country fans.
That's true. There does seem to be a persistent prejudice against the style, even though it's gotten more and more popular. And George Strait has become the elder statesman of country, and when he sings that song, Murder on Country Row, you know, he's the only guy with enough old-school props to sing that song without a hint of irony. But, of course, even when he sings it, it's double-edged. You may not be able to hear Merle Haggard on the radio the way he complains, but more people are listening to country and Western music now than ever before in history. And, of course, more people are aware of Haggard's influence through songs like that. So,
well, except the problem is that some people are listening to current country, you know, like the Dixie Chicks, and I think they think it's pop. But, you know, what is the problem for those who are angry about this, who think that if it is country, they don't want it?
Well, there's this, they hold up an ideal of something that in the past that was smaller scale and was for just plain folks, and they think that it's gotten way out of control and it's gotten too slick and it's gotten too sort of suburbanized for the old rural ideal. There's a lot to say here. For starters, once the Grand Ole Opry got Disneyfied into a theme park, the scale of the country music audience mushroomed to where it was simply not just for plain folks anymore. It is for people in the North just as much as it is for people in the South. And then, of course, you have these crossover acts like Garth Brooks and Shania Twain, who are much more pop in the first place than they ever were country and western, even if they launched from Nashville. And they may use fiddles and banjos in their bands, but they also pose for fashion shoots and they put on arena shows. And if it weren't for the fact that Shania Twain writes and produces all her own material, it wouldn't be hard to imagine Britney Spears singing Shania Twain's new hit, Up.
Even my skin is acting weird. I wish that I could grow a beard. Then I could cover up my spots. Not play connect the dots. I just wanna disappear.
I want to stop at something you said as we listen to Shania Twain. She does write and produce her own music?
Oh, yeah. That's what people don't know about her. I mean, she sort of suffers from this Madonna complex of, you know, being a victim of her own success. She's so popular, people tend to write her off before they actually give her a reasonable listen. She's a very good writer and a very good singer, but she kind of upstages herself with all this fluky costume stuff that she likes to wear. She's also like Dolly Parton that way. I mean, she's very clearly interested in crossing over as big as she can, and she gets attacked for it a lot, especially by the old rootsy Nashville crowd, and I think it's really unfair.
Well, and in fact, her new CD comes with two mixes. You can get two Shania Twain.
Right, which is basically just a marketing gag because the two CDs are so similar. It's very funny, actually, to hear some of these songs. She just sticks banjo on a few of them as if to appease all the people who accuse her of not being country enough because she doesn't have a banjo or a fiddle on her record.
Because one's country and one's pop.
But it barely makes any difference. I mean, it's a pop record. You know, no matter how many banjos you can put on there, it's still a pop record.
Even my skin is acting weird. I wish that I could grow a beard. Then I could cover up my spots. Not play connect the dots. I just want to disappear. Up, up, up. Can only go up from here. Up, up, up. Where the clouds gonna clear. Up, up. There's no way but up from here.
I think this new CD, Up, is the poppiest thing imaginable. It's like an ABBA record. That's what it reminds me of. The melodies are festive, the production is perkier than Katie Couric, and the hooks don't stop.
You can choose a channel when we're watching the TV. All day, it's okay. And you can pick the flavor when we're ordering ice cream. I don't mind. Yeah, that's fine. I do.
To ask you something here, Tim, because you are a pop critic, so of course maybe you'd like Shania Twain's music, but are you a longtime country fan as well?
Oh, I'm a big country fan. In fact, I think the country element in rock and roll, which is my primary passion as a music critic, is really neglected and undervalued and something that people could pay a lot more attention to. The rich vein of country music that is this country's great legacy, I think, alongside jazz.
But it's okay to be a country pop star.
Well, absolutely. I mean, just I think the question is all wrong. It's like, well, how come a country person can't be a pop star, but a rock and roll person could, or a blues person could, or a jazz person could? I mean, how come you get to have a pop figure like Louis Armstrong, but if Hank Williams occupies the same space, there's something wrong with that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a prejudice involved. I think that it's saying, well, this is something country music simply can't be. And I say, well, you know, why not? And why not have Shania Twain be as popular as possible? If it leads people to listening to more roots of country music, then why not? If it leads people to other kinds of music, then why not?
Don't want you for the weekend. Don't want you for a night. I'm only interested if I can have you for life. Yeah.
Well, if I do want to listen to some, you know, my best girl left me and my dog died country songs, what should I choose?
Well, you know what you get when you play your country western music backwards.
What?
You get your car back and your dog back and your wife back. I do recommend this new George Strait record. It's live in Houston at the Astrodome, and it's really got just a great sense of George Strait right there with his audience one-on-one, and it's got a lot of intimacy. I like this record a lot. The other record I recommend to you that is much more rootsy is the Vince Gill record. Now, Vince Gill has sort of this baby face and does really well with the ladies and sings ballads and schmoozes it up, but he's also turned into a real guitar hero. He really knows how to play and lays down a lot of really great guitar on his new record, The Next Big Thing. And I especially like this song that he writes on the record called This Old Guitar and Me.
This old guitar and me, things that we've been through. Well, C.F. Martin built it back in 1942. Well, I remember when we met, I was only 17. I spent all my college money on a half a dozen strings.
I think the main point I want to make here is that I think country and Western music is in really good shape. If you look at everything that's in the top 40, to my ear, the country records are much better aesthetically than almost any other genre. Country music is producing more good songs, built much sturdier, with much better lyrics and with much better melodies than in any other genre, including rap. So I sort of don't get why there's this prejudice around country music being too popular.
Maybe it's the outfits. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and now is pop, rock, and country critic Tim Riley. His book, Tell Me Why, a Beatles Commentary, has just been reissued.
Here it comes.
And before we go, a summary of today's fast-moving events. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has decided that UN weapons inspectors and all UN humanitarian staffers will be leaving Iraq. This following the decision this morning by the U.S., Britain, and Spain to pull from the table a second UN resolution on Iraqi disarmament. President Bush says the time for diplomacy is over. He will address the nation tonight.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.